Portland was in world news headlines last week, and not for a good reason. The double murder on the light rail train in the midst of reported racial harassment shocked many people in many places. But it was another death a day later that prompts this hour's segment. Brian Doyle, the prolific writer, died on Saturday, only 60 years old. His visit here in February of last year was magical. In fact, we had another listener who emailed in just a few moments ago to tell us about he shared emails with Brian Doyle after he heard him on the air here. Got a really delightful email back, sent another email a few months later, and got an autoresponder with an email about Brian Doyle being ill. And Jeff says, "I'm heartbroken, fantastic writer, and as you mentioned, a truly generous person and writer. I just started Chicago, but I'm really heartbroken." So on this, the day of a memorial service for Brian Doyle in Portland, we hear his voice again. When an author writes a book or two, he or she is easy to introduce. You know, here's the author of blank. But when an author writes and writes and writes, the introduction's a bit harder. So it is with Brian Doyle, who writes a lot of material in a lot of different genres. We can give just part of his resume. Brian Doyle is the editor of Portland Magazine at the University of Portland. He's the author of many books of essays and fiction, including the novels Mink River and The Plover. His collections of essays include Bin Laden's Bald Spot and other stories. And his nonfiction books include The Grail, a year ambling and shambling through an Oregon vineyard in pursuit of the best Pinot Noir in the whole wide world, and The Wet Engine, exploring the mad wild miracle of the heart. Brian Doyle, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
It's an honor. Hello, Rogue Valley.
There's more than one published author named Brian Doyle, which I discovered almost in my peril, and was going to ask you about your children's books and not that Brian Doyle.
He's actually a great guy. I've talked to him. He's a very courtly gentleman, Brian Doyle in Ottawa, Canada, and who's their most famous, I think, young adult author. I've talked to him and asked him, you know, people bring me your books to read at my readings. What should I do, Mr. Doyle? Just sign them, for God's sake, he says. Your name's Brian Doyle, isn't it? Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Real nice guy.
Is there a reciprocity there if people bring your books to his reading?
I didn't have the nerve to ask. I knew the answer would be no.
And also, you're not Brian Doyle, the former baseball player, not Brian Doyle Murray, the actor.
No, Brian Doyle played for the Yankees. God help us, the Yankees. I hate the Yankees.
Well, we're just figuring out. You and I actually share some backgrounds. So we're both from Long Island originally. You're from Merrick, New York?
Yeah, down by Jones Beach.
Mm-hmm. Does that make you a Mets fan?
Yes, we grew up Mets fans, partly because you go to the game for $2, mm-hmm. and because the Yankees were an oily, authoritative, snotty corporation. The evil empire is correct, I think.
Yeah. Sounds fair to me, yeah. And in those days, Shea Stadium was worth the $2 because, you know, it smelled kind of funny.
Yeah, it smelled like beer.
Didn't it, though? Yeah, beer and rats, I understand. So you call yourself, and sometimes the ambling, shambling Brian Doyle. Ambling, I think I can figure it out. How does one shamble?
Sort of headlong, shuffling along, you know. Part of that, I have a running competition with a friend of mine to see who can have the longest subtitle in a book. David Duncan, who's a wonderful writer. So I think I was winning briefly with that subtitle. And then he put out a book called My Story is Told by Water, which has a subtitle that goes on, "For the Rest of the Cover." So I lost that one.
Darn it. Well, ambling and shambling through the Oregon vineyard in pursuit of the best Pinot Noir in the whole wide world. You couldn't fit a few more words in there?
No, they had to put a name and a title on the cover, sadly.
Oh, darn it. Had to make room for that. I understand you're most comfortable wearing the title of essayist. And in fact, you were just telling me before we got on the air about your first book was actually done with your father.
Yeah, my dad and I did a collection of my best essays at that point. This is 20 years ago. And he was a columnist in New York City. Beautiful writer. One of the favorite reviews of that book, a book called Two Voices, which had a terrible cover, but one of the reviews said, "The father writes this clean, concise, coherent prose. The son, however, ... My father loved that review and sent it to me every 6 months for several years. FYI, love Dad," which is deeply disturbing.
So what were the essays? I mean, how does one begin working as an essayist? It's pretty easy to go into the family business, I guess. Your dad's a writer, you're a writer.
All my training, I was a journalist. I worked for newspapers and magazines all my life. And at some point I realized I really got fascinated by the essay. It's the closest form to the human voice, I think. It's you sitting with a buddy having a beer saying, "Oh man, remember that time? And there was this guy." And it's just this naked, blunt, open, unfiltered, unadorned form. I really love it. It's the closest to the way that we think and speak, I think. All the other forms, I think, have some kind of filter in some way. Poetry often has this sort of poetic filter, and fiction has that little, there's a little guy in the back of your shoulder saying, "This is made up." But the essay is just sort of blunt and forthright. And I just love it. And you can say a lot in a small space. It's really one of the best things that ever happened to me was to have to write editorial essays for a magazine, because it teaches you to try to say something big in a small stage. You know, 500 words. If you can say something momentous and piercing in 500 words, I think that's a great accomplishment.
But there's also that head-to-the-gun effect of writing columns and things like that, isn't there? It's like, oh, you need one for June. Let's get going now.
And often I think that produces great work. You know, think of the great columnists in America, Mike Royko in Chicago and Murray Kempton in New York and Steve Dean in Portland, I think, was a wonderful essayist at his best. I think deadlines are actually your friends, it seems to me. They force you to sit down and type, you know, rather than be, oh, I'll think about it for a couple of days and go on a sabbatical and consider. No, wrong, man. Sit down. Sit down and type. You know, a lot. My father says if you just sit down and show up every day and type for an hour, you'd be surprised how deep the muck gets at the end of the year, says my dad.
Have you ever taken a sabbatical yourself?
No, I'm not a teacher. I work for the
University. Oh, you work at the University of Portland, yeah. not in it or something.
No, I run the University magazine, so I'm basically in sales and advertising. You know, my job is to convince the universe that they should give us money and send us their children.
What is Portland Magazine about? It's not strictly a literary thing. It's
nominally the alumni magazine. Mm-hmm. Every college and university has an alumni magazine. Many of them are just sort of newsletters with covers. Ours is real ambitious. I want to have absolutely stunning writing, and we're totally addicted to beautiful photography and painting. And I want readers to be moved. I want them to laugh and cry and lose their tempers be pierced by moments, it seems to me. Why not have a real magazine if you're going to have a magazine? That's our theory.
Laugh and cry. Lose their tempers over what, though? And what are some good examples?
Oh, we get a lot of lunatic fringe letters. Partly, I think, because it's a Catholic university magazine. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of Catholic lunatic fringe. You know, we had the Dalai Lama on the cover a couple issues ago. I mean, the Dalai Lama, one of the great spiritual visionaries of our time, was at my university and said, while he was there, there is compassion and there is everything else, which is an extraordinary line and the most Catholic thing I have ever heard. And so, I mean, for any number of reasons, I had him on the cover of the magazine and got several letters saying, how dare you have a pagan on the cover of the magazine?
Really? Pagan was the term used?
Oh, yeah, that was funny. And we, you know, I get a lot of heated response to pieces that say, listen, we're all immigrants. You know, I've gotten furious responses to that. And everybody here is an immigrant from somewhere, so it seems to me. Mm.
Are you not in New York anymore because you outgrew the Long Island temperament? I get to expect Long Islanders to be more like, what are you talking about?
Are you talking to me? No, in my family, as soon as you went to college, you were up and out. And only my youngest brother stayed home, who has an impenetrable New York accent. How you doing?
To this day, yeah. Yeah. There's no Oz anywhere.
Freaking Mets.
Well, they weren't freaking Mets this year because at least they got to the World Series.
I know, it's shocking. But then they lost.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, they had to revert
freaking
to form.
Mets.
Freaking Mets. Brian Doyle cracking wise in February of last year. He died last weekend at Lake Oswego at age 60, and the world is definitely a poorer place for it. You'll hear more of the expression of Brian Doyle's wonderful mind when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Chautauqua Poets and Writers brings big-name writers to the Rogue Valley on a regular basis and offers all of them to us for interviews. We're especially grateful that we got to visit with Brian Doyle in February 2016. He died last weekend in the Portland area, just 60 years old. He left a huge volume of writing behind and this interview. So it sounds like you pretty much from the time you were first verbal have gotten used to this idea of you get up and write at some point during the day.
Well, I was lucky. My dad was a newspaper man. My mom was a teacher, a big Irish Catholic family. So it's a lot of stories in the house and voices and books everywhere. And because my dad was a newspaper guy, we got newspapers and magazines from everywhere. We probably had 70, no kidding, periodicals in the house. So reading and writing and storytelling, and especially I think as Irish and American and Catholic, those are story-addled cultures, you know. Mm-hmm. Very orally based, and telling stories is totally normal. And if you had no stories in your mouth in my family, my mom didn't know your name.
Really?
So, yeah. I'm not sure if she knows my brother Tommy's name. She calls him Eight.
Is that how many kids are in the family?
Yeah, the original. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So I'm sorry for going off on a Long Island reverie here, but I think you're old enough to remember when there was still Newsday, the Long Island Press.
Yeah, I delivered them. I delivered Long Island Press a long time ago. And then one great thing about having younger brothers is that you can make them do it for you, right? With threat of violence.
So you did spend some time for newspapers yourself, is that right?
I worked for papers when I was in Boston. When I was fresh out of college, I worked in Chicago for a couple of years for a magazine, and then in Boston for years and years, first with newspapers and then with Boston College Magazine. And that led me to the University of Portland. I fell in love with an Oregonian. That's how we got to Oregon.
Right, which you have to stop pronouncing in the first
place. Oregon, day, so. Yeah. And but she was a subtle woman. She would bring me out here when we were recording only in August and September. So,
So
I thought
was
this
raining.
Was the most sunny paradise ever. What a shock. These last 25 years have been a huge shock to me.
So let's talk. I mean, there's so many different things you write about. Why don't we go to your most recent novel? Is Martin Martin the most recent one?
Yeah, I have one coming out in next month. I have a novel called Chicago about the cityness of Chicago to some degree. But Martin Martin came out last spring.
And Martin Martin is actually a pine marten, right?
Yeah, pine marten. In readings, I have to now say, I've learned to say to people, does anybody know what a marten is? Because they're kind of remote and slippery. You don't really see them unless you're deep in the woods usually. I saw Martin for the first time ever while drinking a glass of wine and looking out the window at Timberline Lodge. I saw Pine Martin, a great wilderness experience with a glass of wine in your hand. I set out to write a book. I love those books about kids and animals, you know, Old Yeller and Big Red and women have all read Black Beauty and Misty of Chincoteague and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I set out to write a book about a kid and an animal, and it just sort of got out of hand, as usual with my novels. I have no idea what's going on in my novels.
Do novels, I mean, do they start off as short stories and just don't stop?
It's kind of like, that happened with Mink River. Mink River started as a short story and then just completely jumped into the future with me desperately typing behind the character saying, wait. it was really weird. I would show up in the morning, every morning, and open up the file, and it was like the characters are standing there going, man, where have you been? Let's go. Let's rock. Let's go. Novels, I find, you have an idea, and you just take it out for a walk, and then it changes as it goes, I think. And I guess you could write a novel where you figure the whole thing out ahead of time. That must be how you write detective novels and police procedurals and stuff, but my novels, I have no idea what's going on, and the characters are totally real. I can hear them talking, and my father says, really, you have voices in your head. It's like, Pop.
Seriously. So I'm always amazed at the way that writers can play with time like it's an accordion. You know, it's compressed here and it's pulled out there. And the description of the tree at the opening of Martin Martin puts essentially decades into a couple of paragraphs.
Actually, one of the great things about a novel in particular, I think, is that you can use all the tools you can use. You can play with time. You can have the eye range everywhere. You can run things backwards. You can have animals do things. You know, you can imagine anything. And there's a huge freedom in fiction, it seems to me, especially. I'm a student of this because I love the essay so much. The essay, you got to keep one foot on the ground. You can soar and have fun and goof, but you got to have a toe still attached to what we call reality. Fiction, you can play all kinds of games, man. I mean, think how many great novels are written deep in space, you know. I mean, Ursula Le Guin is a genius, and there's four or five Ursula Le Guin novels that are set way on other planets, man, and they're totally real. You are sucked into that world, you know. And that's one of the great things about novels, that you get sucked into the world, and there should be a word for it. As you finish a great book, you're really bummed out because you know the end is coming, and you slow down, and you want to know what's going to happen, but you're slowing down because you feel a little sad because you turn that last page, man, and you're done, and you're never going to get back to that feeling again, you know? I got an angry letter recently from a lady who said, I just read your book, Mink River, and I got it all the way to the end, and then it ended. She was kind of upset. I was like, I'm so sorry. I had to stop.
Mink River was actually Mink River and the Plover are basically connected, aren't they?
The Plover's not a sequel. It's just one guy that comes out of Mink River. Not to blow it for everybody listening who hasn't read Mink River, but one guy, he leaves the book, basically. And no kidding, 100 times people said to me at book clubs and readings and stuff, hey, what happened to that guy? And so I finally thought, you know, what did happen to that guy? So the Plover is like a 300-page answer to what happened to that guy. So it's not a sequel, but it's kind of a companion. I think I want to do it one more time. It'd be fun to do three of those.
Really? Yeah. One more?
Just for fun.
Brian Doyle's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You got some stuff here. You got a few piles of things that you could potentially get into for reading here.
Yeah, let me read. I'd love to read a piece of Mink River if I can. It'd be fun.
Absolutely.
There's a scene down the end of Mink River. There's a guy he's a timekeeper throughout the book. He's got 13 days to live, 11 days to live, 3 days to live. And down the end of the book, I think he's got like 3 days to live. And a young guy says to him, "Hey, man, what mattered in your life? What mattered to you? And don't give me faith, family, and friends. Don't give me that. Answer the question for real. What mattered to you?" And the old man says, "Hawks huddled disgruntled against hissing snow, wrens in winter thickets, swallows carving and slicing and swimming in fat, grinning summer air. Thimbleberries, raspberries, cloudberries, snowberries, my children learning to read, the sinuous liquid flow of rivers and minks and cats, fresh bread with way too much butter, my children's hands when they cut my ancient grizzled face in their hands, exuberance and ebullience, tears of sorrow to the salt seas of the heart, sleep in every form from doze to bone weary, the shivering ache of a saxophone and the yearning of an oboe, folding laundry hot from the dryer, cobblers and tailors, spotless kitchen floors, the way horses smell in spring, postcards in which the sender has written so much that he or she can barely squeeze in the signature, opera on the radio, toothbrushes, the postman's grin, the green sifting powdery snow of cedar pollen on the porch every year, the way herons labor through the sky with such vast elderly dignity, people who care about hubcaps, the cheerful ears of dogs, all photographs of every sort, tip jars, wine glasses, the way barbers sweep up circles of hair after haircut so courteously, so politely, handkerchiefs in your pocket, libraries, poems read aloud by older poets, fedora hats, excellent knives, the very idea of albatrosses, the tiny screws that hold your spectacles together, book marginalia, people who keep dead languages alive, wooden rulers, cabbages, kings, eulogy, elegy, puppetry, bass, bluefish, furriers, farriers, trout and grout, peach pies of every size, the sprawling porches of old hotels and the old men who sprawl upon them, the snoring of children, the sound of my daughter typing her papers for school in the other room, the sound of my sons wrangling and wrestling and howling and yowling, all sounds of whatever tone or tenor issue from my children in all other forms of coupled pain and joy, which is to say everything alive, which is to say all prayers, which is what I just did. Amen.
Mm. Wow. Brian Doyle, this is from Mink River?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, and this is the answer to the question, what are you going to miss?
What matters to you? What matters to you?
More than family, faith, and friends, clearly.
Yeah, so many people answer that question sort of loosely, you know, with a cliche. But really what matters to you is all those little tiny things. All those little tiny things are not tiny. That's what I often think. What everything that I write in the end, what is it about? There's no small things, man. All the small things are not. That's basically, I think, where it's at.
Brian Doyle, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the editor of Portland Magazine and a prolific author based in Portland. You know, I make the same observation with you. I make with all the writers we get in, particularly from Chautauqua, is that you don't miss a detail. When you got it to the point of talking about the little screws that hold your eyeglasses together, everything is important.
Oh, yeah. All the little tiny things that are so sweet and funny, like women always wear those clips in their hair, you know, so when you kiss them from behind, a clip explodes in your face. You know, and don't you love stuff like that? And the way little kids hold your hand. And I just wrote a piece about my kids. I really miss my kids holding my hand. My kids are old now, and our kids, they didn't come out of me. But, you know, when they're little, they hold your hand with such avid, heartfelt, trust, you know, and my daughter used to hold just my pinky. And I miss that so bad. You know, those little things are what your life is made of, isn't it? I mean, so at the end, when people say, "What'd you do?" Your job wasn't really so much what you did. It was all those ways that you loved and let people love you and gave darkness the finger. That was really what your life was about, wasn't it?
Gave darkness the finger.
Yeah. You know, like, how could you bring laughter as a weapon? And how much tenderness did you share? You know, that's where your life is at. Mm.
I always wonder with somebody who writes as many different things as you write, if it's, I mean, you're essentially writing about yourself. I mean, is it one thing, or are you writing about all these different things that interest you?
No, yeah, actually, one of the great epiphanies I had as a writer was it's not about me. It was a huge shock when I was like 29, 30, man, to discover, whoa, everybody else is more interesting. Oh, what a bummer. Except it was hugely productive as a man and hugely better for me as a writer.
Sounds like a bit of a weight lifted off you too.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating. You begin to realize, oh, witnessing everybody else is where it's at. And so that writing to me is fun and easy. And, you know, it's not labor. It's a matter of how many people can I listen to before I get kicked off the planet, you know? And because everybody has stories. Everybody has everybody carries their scars. Everybody has stories of sort of defiant courage, and I love that. I like it, knocks me out, and you know, to just listen and pay attention. I feel like the world is handing me stories hand over fist, you know, and I get accused of being prolific, and I don't think it's fair. I think it's just that I get slathered and inundated by stories, you know, and my job is to, like, catch a few of them, you know, and type as fast as I can. Thank God my dad taught me to type fast.
I was going to ask, you mentioned when you first came in that it's not writing so much as just typing. I type, you know, so how fast do you type?
You probably, you know, 60, 70 words a minute, but I type with two fingers because my dad taught me. He was an old newspaper guy. You type with your four fingers, right? He still, to this day, he types like 100 words a minute and can talk to you as he's typing. That kind of classic old journalist, you know.
Wow, that's an amazing skill. 94 years old, you were saying?
94, yeah, he'd be 95 next month. Pop's a great guy. He can read stuff upside down and backwards because he used to do hot lead type back in the old days.
Sure,
that's how old he is, you know, and... but he was a wonderful teacher of writing by never trying to be. You know, he would just say, tell me a story, tell me a story. That the lyricism and the beauty and the sinew of the writing were are second and tenth to the story. Tell me a story. My lovely bride is my first reader of all my stuff, and she's a great first reader because she doesn't really care about the beauty of the writing. She cares about the pop of the story, right? So the kiss of death from her is, oh, that's nice. That means you should take it out and shoot it, you know. Whereas if she says, oh, my God, then what happened? You know, that there we go. Then we got a piece of writing.
So has it ever been much of an effort for you to get out of the way of the story? Or it sounds like it comes pretty naturally to you.
Yeah, I mean, I know my own sins. I mean, you know, age confers no wisdom, but experience teaches you what you stink at. And I know myself well enough. I'm liable to sentimentality probably. I'm addicted to the playfulness and the swing and the cadence of the American language. I love. And so I have to be a little careful to not play too hard. You know, like, I mean, I would happily write 1,000-word sentences, man. And at some point, you got to throw a period in just on principle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed a couple of those, and I'm trying to think of which one it was I was reading here, but it just went, the sentence went on and on and on. And in fact, I think some people have referred to you as the master of the run-on sentence.
Yeah, but you can. I like the serpentine, sinuous, riverine flow and rhythm and cadence of sentences. You know, and there's no. I mean, nobody talks in subject verb object sentences. That's silly. Nobody talks that way. I want to write like people talk. People talk and think in kind of loose flowing, bumpy ways, and I love that. I want to play with that. But I'm obsessed with clarity. I want my stuff to be clear. I hate stream of consciousness. I think it's selfish. But, you know, given that constraint, why not have some fun with the language? American is a great language, man. Lewd and funny and vulgar and sweet and salty and dirty. It's a lovely language to play with.
Have there been any stops between the Northeast? And you mentioned working in Chicago for a while, I guess. And then,
yeah, I went to Notre Dame and then lived in Chicago. Great city. I love Chicago. Probably a great American city, I think. And then lived in Boston for years and years. And then fell in love with an Oregonian in Boston and then came out to Oregon many years ago, 25 years ago.
Wow. The reason for the question was to find that if you'd ever had a chance to spend some time in other corners of the country, like in the Deep South or in Texas or someplace where the American language is alive and well, obviously, but different from what you've been around.
You know, I've traveled some and been struck by how languages change form constantly. You know, the first time I was in Australia, I remember talking to a little girl who said, we're using the same words but speaking different languages. And she was totally right. It was really interesting to hear another version of, I don't think we speak English. I think it's American. Mm-hmm. This is why I think Twain is our greatest writer, is because he was the first one to write American.
Mm-hmm. Brian Doyle, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So your most recently published novel, Martin Martin, is young adult. I mean, how do you set out to make a young adult book, or is it just that your publisher categorizes it that way?
No, I set out to write a book about a kid and an animal, and it got out of hand and turned out to be, I think, about sort of love and reverence and the mountain. It's Wai'east. I hate the word Mount Hood. It annoys me no end. Hood was an English admiral who never saw it and had no idea what was going on. And the guy who named it was just sucking up to the English, you know, admiral. So it just annoys me no end. Wai'east is a very good name for the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to write a book that I thought any kid, you know, age 12 or up should be able to read it. So I think anybody 12 to, you know, 112 would enjoy it. But I did That the only thing I had in my mind with young adults was I wanted kids to be able to read it. So I tried to write a little more cleanly and it probably failed egregiously.
Is it easy to forget that approach as you're going along?
Oh, totally.
And then go back and have to strip out the stuff? Or
no, you just do it. In my experience, you do it as and have fun and listen to people. I try to witness the characters, right? Like listen to them and let them be them. And Mink River taught me a great lesson. You can't control them. Every time I tried to make people do things, they were just lifeless puppets. And finally I realized you just got to let go. And off they go. And often they do things that you don't want. You don't want them to do. I would cover my eyes thinking, oh, no, don't go out with that guy. That guy's a horse's ass. No. But, if they're real, I mean, I think the secret to a great novel is the characters are completely real. You should miss them, I think, when the book is over. You should think about them and kind of miss them and maybe recognize them in people coming past you in the street.
So you mentioned that it was a lot of people asking about what happened to the guy in Mink River that led to the writing of the Plover.
Yeah.
I mean, so did you ever miss the characters enough to want to go back and try again?
Or? I can still hear their voices, oddly, but I don't want to write sequels. I just don't have the attention span for it. and to me, novels are like ideas. My editor, who's a great guy, says a novel's a really long working out of an idea. And I think Mink River in particular, I think the idea ultimately was Oregon-ness. I wanted to write down the shaggy grace, the sort of moist camaraderie of Oregon. It seems quite real to me. And often I think now that I think Mink River was a way to say thank you to Oregon for me. I'm not from here, but everybody I love is from Oregon. And Oregon's given me so much joy and rain and pain and grace. And I think it's kind of a long thank you, one of my favorite reviews was somebody said, the only book that this can be compared to fairly is Sometimes a Great Notion, and Doyle's is kinder hearted. That blew my mind.
Wow, I could see that.
I was like, whoa, I'd love to shake hands with Ken Kesey and say, hey, man, hey, check this out.
Well, we've been checking this out for a while now. Brian Doyle had such a great facility for making people laugh. He joined us on The Exchange 15 months ago. He died last week in Lake Oswego, way too young. You'll hear the rest of the interview when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. This hour of the program is born of sadness because we're observing the passing of the prolific writer Brian Doyle, writer of novels, essays, poems, and the editor of Portland Magazine. Chautauqua Poets and Writers brought him to the Rogue Valley in February of last year before his December diagnosis of brain cancer. He died last week. Here's the rest of the interview with the original phone calls still on board. Here's a question from Seth in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Brian Doyle.
Hi, thanks for having me again. Brian, first of all, I love listening to this conversation. It just, the way that you describe things is, I have a lot of those, thoughts throughout the day, and I have a question for you is how you organize those. Like, for example, I'll get through a feeling some day of nostalgia or just wanting to remember how I feel in that moment, and I say, well, I got to write this down, and I got to remember this, exactly how I feel in this moment. But how do you go through an essay without completely losing yourself in that thought? How do you organize yourself to where you're not just rambling? You make it coherent to where it actually sounds like a beginning, middle, and end. And it's not just a random mess of words.
All right. Thanks for the question, Seth.
That's a great question. I guess I sort of don't. One of the things I've learned as a writer is if you have an urge, if you have an itch, if you have an idea, if something's bugging you and niggling at you, sit down and go. Burn it all down, blurt it all out. Don't think. And because you can always go over it afterwards and cut out the parts that are not working. So if I have I was telling Jeffrey, I wrote a piece recently about my little kids holding my hands and our children, and I just blurt it all down, and then you can go over it with a cold-hearted killer's eye and take out the nonsense. And it's easy to edit, and it's easy to fix things, and it's easy to think afterwards. But I tell kids when I talk to students, I tell them, the worst thing you can do while you're writing is think. Don't think, and just burn it all down on the page, and then you can play with it later. One of the things that works for me is being an editor by trade. I have no respect for Brian Doyle, the writer, at all. So I tend to write a lot. I'll write in a great burst, and then I go over it and kind of clean it. I usually can get most of the feeling, because the other thing for me is to tell it as a story. Don't write down how you think and how you feel. Tell me a story, and then inside the story, shimmering around the story, will be the feeling. You know, if you're nostalgic for something, I try to remember a moment. You know, I find myself talking about my children and my family a lot that way, just as a story. I just tell a story and let it be. You know, don't comment. That's another thing I've learned as an essayist, is don't write your opinion. Don't write your comment. Don't write your consideration. Just tell me a story. And the story has a lot. The stories have real big shoulders. You know, stories carry a lot of weight. Often a little tiny lean story has such a shimmer of emotion in it. And you don't have to say that. Just let the story be itself. Write the bones, I guess, is what I'm thinking at.
So you're very much an advocate of charging in and then coming back later and doing the cleanup. Don't try to edit along the way.
No, and I'll often finish a piece and think, you know, that is the greatest thing ever written. And then I wait, let it go cold for a day. And then the next day you're like, oh, boy, that needs to be repaired.
Is that usually a good waiting time, a day? You just sleep on it?
Yeah, let it go cold. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It turns out the Beach and Jack Kerouac are totally wrong. You know, the stuff that you just blurt down on the page. Oh, it's art. No, it isn't. It's not, it's not art until you've taken out the fat parts and listen to the music, too. It's another thing I try to do when I think I'm finished. Often I'll read a piece out loud to see if it's got any music in it. Mm. Does that help?
Yeah, the sense of music. I read somewhere that you would write of wanting to push the prose close to music, but also drive the language hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cool. When we speak to each other, there's a music and a song in the way that we speak. I think there's tone and timbre and tenor, and it just fascinates me the way that the voice can play and braided voices. A lot of what a novel is, I think, is just braided voices and stories. And
voices of several people braided together, you mean?
Or, yeah, yeah, often. And then depending who the narrator is, you know. Like I just started a novel. I heard a voice talking, and I thought, okay, write it down. I don't know who's talking. I had no idea. And it took me a while. It took me weeks to figure out who the guy was, you know. And then I realized, wow, this is weird. Like, turned out the guy was a bass player in a band, and I don't know anything about music, so now I'm totally up a creek. I have to learn everything about music in about a year. So, does that help? Does that help, Seth?
Yeah, Seth is off the line now, but thanks for the question very much. In the writing process, are there ever times you just like you want to chuck it across the room, and it frustrates you as you go, or are you just that non-judgmental as you are first committing?
Oh, there's you can feel stiffness. You can feel that you're working too hard. It's like the engine's racing a little too hard, and then you just keep going, and you know, you have bad days. It doesn't work. But there's a great line that I think the two greatest lines ever written in Oregon were written by William Stafford, not by Ken Kesey or Ursula Le Guin or Barry Lopez or David Duncan, all wonderful writers from Oregon. But Stafford, the first one was, "Violence is a failure of the imagination." What a line. Oh, my God. And the second one was, "When in doubt, lower your standards." So I try to live by the second line as a writer, you know. I mean, you do the best you can, and if it's not working, put it aside and do something else. You know, this is another one of my theories, is that you really shouldn't do the same project for 20 years, man. I mean, do the best you can and then move on and do another one and another one. And there I think my journalism background probably helps. You know, as a journalist, you learn, do the best you can, you know, get it down, shape it, and, you know, move it on, and then do another one and another one and another one. And I think that actually really helps you as a writer to just keep going, keep going.
You have luxuries as a non-journalist that you don't have as a journalist, because, you know, a journalist has to be able to, and particularly now when you're committing to the web all the time, you have to crank stuff out all the time. When what's the famous story about the journalism is like inviting people to a dinner party and you don't have chairs for all the guests or food for all the guests or even enough silverware, but you gotta be able to serve people there.
Yeah, but I think journalism is actually, it's one thing, it's great training as a writer, because it teaches you to get your ego back in the box. Listen to people, find the story, listen for the little details that tell you the whole story. You know, often it's a little tiny wrinkle that where the story really lives. And also, I think journalism is, in a funny way, more crucial than ever before. You know, so much of our public discourse is sales and lies and illusion and shouting and rage and insistence on the unreal. You know, I mean, so much of politics, for example, is just completely performance theater. It has no basis at all in fact. And I mean, facts are shoddy enough things as they are, but But journalists, I think, more than ever before, are crucial to say, okay, that would be total nonsense. You know, here's actually what happened there. And insisting on the same stupid thing again and again doesn't make it true. So I think young people, you know, it used to be the papers were a great place to train as a writer. But I think that being a journalist now as a young person is a great opportunity. All these cool new toys are being invented to share stories. You know, it's a great time. You know, journalism was never a place to get a whole lot of money. Mm-mm. So
less so now, it seems.
And that hasn't changed. Yeah. So, I mean, if, you know, stupid me, I was in high school recently. A kid said, so you're a journalist. Why'd you become a journalist? I said, to get the girls. I was like, oh, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Wow, I'm stupid. But I got the girl.
So do you ever move into the realm of the political? Do your essays ever get into what's going on in the political discourse now?
Yeah. One of my huge pet peeves in life is people saying family values as a kind of a slogan or a flag. It's a completely empty thing. And it's funny how many people say family values and they have absolutely no concept of taking care of children and schooling and doctors and food and water and homes and beds. And it just annoys me no end. You know, how can you say that you're for family values and not want to feed? There's 100,000 kids in Oregon tonight who don't have enough to eat. So the next guy who says family values and doesn't say, and I will hike myself down to a homeless shelter, is a buffoon and a liar. And so once in a while that boils out and I write a steaming piece. I just wrote an open letter to the leader of Daesh, you know.
ISIS or
yeah,
ISIL.
Daesh is the right word. That's the Arabic slang for cockroach, and I think that's the proper word. I wrote an open letter to him saying, hey, I read the Quran, my friend, and nowhere in the Quran does it say that you can slaughter innocents. That's a lie. And if you say that you're defending Islam and slaughtering innocents because it says so in your book, that's a lie, and I'm going to call you out on it. So my wife is very upset. She thinks, you know, they're going to issue a fatwa. I said, what, against an essayist? I think not.
Probably not. Yeah, the essayist is Brian Doyle here on the Jefferson Exchange. You have something else you want to read before we have to wrap it up?
Yeah, let me read a little piece just for sheer fun. I'm very aware that I'm visiting high school. High school, I'm here. There'll be a lot of high school kids tonight at the theater. In fact, I'm at the high school. So whenever I visit high schools, I'd love to read this little poem just for fun because it makes everybody uncomfortable. It makes me laugh. So let me read you this. First Kiss, this is called. One thing no one ever informs you of when you get ready to kiss a girl for the first time is where to put your nose. Do you lay it alongside hers like a skipper eases his ship along a dock, or do you take turns alternating left and right? You laugh, but this is a pressing question, as you well remember yourself. And the glasses on each of your noses, is it sweet when they clink, or is that dorky? Should you take them off just before you kiss, or is that too confident that you will be kissing? And most of all, most important of all, the breathing. This is a real problem. Do you hold your breath? Do you aim for staggered breaths like in the pool? Who's in charge of the situation? If one person wants to retire, what are the accepted signal flags for such a decision? Can you appeal? I hear you laughing, but you were in the same boat as me. We were shaking. We so wanted to do this well and so wanted not to be seen to want to. In a sense, it was practice for so very many things that we would want but did not know how to get or why or what to do with after we got them. You know full well what I mean. Nothing was as gently sweet, nothing so roaringly nerve-wracking. How could both things be true at once? How could that be? Yet it was so, and it would be hourly more so the rest of your life.
First Kiss, a little work from Brian Doyle, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Here again, it's good writing and good comedy, for that matter, too, are based on picking up the things that we all know,
but we
never talk about with each other, like where the nose goes when
you
kiss.
Right. Somebody asked me, I read that in high school, and a kid said, oh, yeah, who was the first girl you ever kissed? I said, Teresa O'Connell, 8th grade. I had glasses, and she had braces, so it was like spaceships docking in deep space.
I had not asked about writers that you did mention William Stafford and some other great Oregon writers as well. But who are some of the people who really impressed you as you?
Oh, my!
It sounds like you read as voraciously as you write.
Yeah, but I tend to read. I'm very poorly read in modern writing. Interesting, but well read in older writing. Like I love Plutarch and. But for me, my favorite writer of all time is Robert Louis Stevenson. I think he's the greatest writer who ever wrote this language. I think the great American writer is Twain. I love E.B. White. I think E.B. White is one of our greatest writers ever. He was a superb essayist and wrote wonderful novels. He wrote three great novels, and Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web, but he was a great essayist. Can I give homework on the radio?
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody should read One Man's Meat by E.B. White. It's a collection of his essays, and it has Once More to the Lake and Death of a Pig. Oh, my God, that guy's a great essayist.
There was, I wish I could remember it now, but there was something I read of his or a line of his recently that somebody else brought up, and it was like, oh, my God, that's brilliant. You know?
Just, oh, he's great. And he has this artless he was a master of the art of artlessness. You know, he seems to just have spoken his words onto the page. So I aspire to that.
Are there any writers that you're like 10-foot pole land, 11-foot pole? It's like, stay away.
That I don't like reading and
yes.
can't stand? Let's not go here, Jeffrey. there's so many. I mean, I feel like we're totally spoiled in Oregon. You know, Barry Lopez lives here, man. Barry Lopez is a genius. And Ursula Le Guin lives in Portland.
She wrote a letter to the editor of the Oregonian recently.
Oh, and as usual, she was the smartest person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, really, you're defending the public's right. Right. And she goes, I'm in the public. I pay taxes for this land. You know, and she's brilliant. I sign books with her once a year, and we have the same conversation. I go to her and say, hi, Ursula, I'm Brian Doyle. And she says, Brian, I know who the hell you are. We shake hands. And see, it's become a tradition. I get a kick out of it.
That's a good thing to hear from Ursula Le Guin.
And she's about 4 feet tall and tough. Boy, she could beat both of us up.
Mm. We'll have to give her a try sometime. We have an email here from Jeff in Ashland who writes, much thanks to Brian Doyle. Our friend lent me Mink River last year, and it is one of the finest books I've ever enjoyed, and I did indeed slow way down to savor it near the end.
Oh, good man. I love Jeff in Ashland, a deeply discerning man, I feel, in the literary sense. Actually, that book, it's interesting to me. Mink River, people either really, really love it or people cannot bear it. And my brothers love collecting all the zero-star reviews of Mink River, which they send to me on a regular basis.
Zero-star review, the ones where people yes. go, oh, this is a piece of...
Why was this, you know, what uh-huh. publisher allowed this to happen? That was, mm-hmm. you know, I loved in my reading, actually, in my readings, I read the top 10 nasty things said about Mink River, which my brothers keep for me.
Uh-huh. That's good.
Lovely
that you
boys.
Have, yeah, you know. Keep things organized for you. You mentioned Robert Louis Stevenson. I forgot your next book. The Chicago is your next novel.
Yeah, it comes out in March.
Okay.
Sometime. But and then after that... Right, a year later, in 2000, where are we? What
year are we?
2018.
Yeah.
I wrote a novel about Robert Louis Stevenson. Stevenson lived in San Francisco, unbelievably, for about 5 months, 4 or 5 months, and was going to write a book about his landlady's husband named John Carson, and he never did it. It's just one reference, one little line, and I thought to myself, I'm doing it. So I wrote the novel that Stevenson didn't write, and I'm still... so proud of myself. It's like, wow, that would be fun. And it turns out to be sort of a love letter to Stevenson, partly, and to San Francisco. It's a very city book, it seems to me. It's in 1880, so I had to do a lot of research about what was it like in San Francisco in 1880. It was a lot smaller. for
no
one
doubt.
Thing.
So Chicago this spring, and then the San Francisco Stevenson book next spring.
All right, John Carson.
All right, all kinds of fun stuff coming out of Brian Doyle. Thank you so much for joining us
sure.
today on the Jefferson Exchange.